This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Sharon Thornberry wrote a chapter. Sharon is Oregon Food Bank's community food systems manager, and she is with us on the phone. Hello, Sharon.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us on the KBOO Food Show.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So you are the community food systems manager at the Oregon Food Bank, and I don't want to spend a lot of time with the Oregon Food Bank today, but I'd like to know what you do.
So community food systems program at Oregon Food Bank is aimed at having food secure communities that do not have to depend on the emergency food system, particularly in rural communities. So we do rural community organizing and community food assessment. We provide technical assistance and support to grassroots organizations that are working on rebuilding their community's food systems.
Thank you. And can you tell our listeners about A Place at the Table?
A Place at the Table is a project that was started several years ago by two filmmakers, and Tom, and I'm going to mispronounce his name, but from Top Chef, Tom Colicchio, and his wife is one of the filmmakers. And their aim was to document the current state of what it's like to be hungry in the United States, because it's very hard for people to get a picture of what that is. You know, it's hunger is not distended bellies as it is in third world countries, and it takes on many different faces and elements depending on where you live and what your situation is. And so they went to a gentleman who is on the board of Bread for the World, and that's an organization I also belong to get backing for this. And Bread for the World became involved in several other organizations like Share Our Strength and Feeding America, and made this documentary that tells the story of hunger in this country through the eyes of the three people that you mentioned.
And can you tell us about your role with A Place at the Table?
So the folks who make Place at the Table are also the same people who made Waiting for Superman and Inconvenient Truth and Food, Inc. And they always do a companion book to their project. And I was asked to write one of the chapters in the book because of what my own experience with hunger, and because I now work for Oregon Food Bank. And so I've been involved in, after being in the situation of being hungry and homeless with two children 40 years ago now, I came to work for food banking and have worked since for the last 28 years to make sure other people don't end up in that situation, and that we are able to change the systems we need to change.
And which reminds me, how has the system changed in those 40 years, 40 years ago for you?
Ironically, what has happened is that food banking has become the solution to hunger. And what this film points out very well is that we had solved hunger through public programs in the 70s and 80s, and then as we took funds away from those programs, we've become dependent on a charitable response to hunger, and it's just not enough. And it's not a good way to make sure we feed our fellow Americans. And yet, it is the system that we have. And so that's the film talks about that. But, you know, the first time I found myself in a situation where I didn't have anything to eat, I went to one of my neighbors. I was in a place where I didn't know anyone. Went to one of my neighbors. My children were 2 and 5. Told them I didn't have anything for my kids. They took me to a food stamp office on the north side of Houston. And at that point, you had to pay a share of your food stamps. And it took a minimum of 3 days. It didn't matter whether or not you had food to get your food stamps. And so I was given food stamps. I was qualified for food stamps, but of course couldn't get them right away. My neighbor gave me $5 to go to the grocery store with. And the other thing that was interesting, you know, that was the first time I'd ever seen a food closet or food pantry, was that in this social service center in North Houston, they had established a brand new food pantry, but nobody knew who had the key. Uh-huh. So they took me down and showed me the food pantry through the window, but I didn't actually get any food.
Hmm. And you know some of the people in the documentary. I'm thinking about Barbie, and I'm kind of hearing some parallels between your story and Barbie's story. Can you talk about Barbie a little bit?
Yes. And I had the pleasure of being on a panel with Barbie a little over two weeks ago in Washington, D.C. at a conference. She's an amazing young woman, and there are a lot of parallels with her experience. I think the thing and Barbie is now going to college and doing pretty, she has the things she needs, and her kids are able to eat. But I very much related to her experience of being concerned about wasting food and how hard it was to make sure that you had the right food for your kids. And then going to work and no longer qualifying for programs.
Still struggling to feed your children at that point.
And then still struggling for food and there being no one to help you. Mm-hmm. Because you didn't qualify for the federal programs and you no longer qualified for a food box because you had a job.
So we only have about
in Philadelphia.
We only have another minute or a minute and a half for you. Sharon, so can you quickly maybe tell us a little bit about the actions that we need to take?
So I would suggest people, this film is playing in Hollywood Theater through tomorrow night. It's also available on demand and on iTunes. Watch the film, learn about the federal programs, let your legislators know that there's no reason we shouldn't be ending hunger in America through legislative action, through policy work. And then also think about, just have a better understanding of what it is like to be hungry in this country and put away some of your stereotypes and take a serious look at what the reality is.
Thank you so much for being with us on the Food Show this morning, Sharon.
All right. Thank you.
So genetically engineered salmon is an issue that's facing us right now. It's current. We're currently in a commenting period, and I looked up information about it, and it was kind of difficult to find. So I decided to put together a little primer, and here is that primer. Genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, spend a lot of time in the media limelight. This is not only due to the potential impacts they have on our economy, ecology, and food system, but also because they have a science fiction appeal. Genetic engineering, in general, conjures up imagery of the mad scientist, of experiments where playing God goes horribly awry and leads to chaos and suffering all over the world. Repeatedly, genetic engineering is defended by the biotech industry as a means to facilitate the feeding of an ever-growing population. But as much as corporations and researchers they employ push to get GMOs accepted for market, there is an equal, if not stronger, backlash from concerned consumers. One reason is that the biotech corporations pushing these products oftentimes employ suspect practices. For example, one of the arguments touted by biotech corporations for genetically modified seeds is that they will help reduce or eliminate the need for synthetic pesticides, something environmentalists like to hear. Yet, since the approval of the first GM seed, pesticide use has increased primarily due to the widespread utilization of Roundup Ready crops. The first genetically modified animal is being thrown into this volatile arena. Genetically engineered salmon, or Frankenfish as it is commonly referred to by its opponents, has been deemed safe for human consumption and is nearing approval by the Food and Drug Administration. This new food will potentially reach meat sections of the grocery by the end of this year, and it seems like there are so many questions still unanswered about this product. If you look to the media or online outlets for information about genetically engineered salmon, you will find surprisingly little besides opposition. I tried to contact Aqua Bounty, the biotech company working on the salmon, for an interview to get their side of the issue and received no response. I also searched for videos and sound clips of people explaining or defending the genetically engineered fish and found little. All of the information I am including from Aqua Bounty's perspective can be found on their website. So here is an introduction to genetically engineered salmon, aka Frankenfish 101. Let's start at the beginning. How exactly is this genetically engineered salmon different from regular farmed salmon? I asked this question to Ocean Robbins, the co-founder and CEO of the Food Revolution Network, and here is his response.
Well, scientists have spliced genes from an eel-like creature called the ocean tout, and they've also taken another gene from the Chinook salmon, and they've spliced them into the Atlantic salmon. And the goal with these genes is to crank out growth hormone year-round. See, normally salmon only grow certain times of year, but now with these genes spliced in, they'll grow year-round, making a fish that will grow many times faster, which cuts down the time to market weight almost in half.
On the Aqua Bounty website, you can see a short video showing the DNA of the Chinook salmon and ocean pout splicing together and then entering the Atlantic salmon. There are also nutritional differences between the GE salmon and other salmon.
Unfortunately, the salmon isn't all the same. Nutrition facts show that the genetically engineered salmon has lower rates of omega-3 fatty acids, higher levels of fat, and lower levels of protein.
So the purpose of creating a genetically engineered salmon is to produce a fish that reaches a marketable size very fast. Aqua Bounty and the biotech industry are excited to get this salmon approved as quickly as possible so that they can start profiting from it. But what about possible negative impacts? Aqua Bounty has made this statement about the inability for fish to reproduce in the wild. A quick note, they refer to Aqua Advantage eggs, which is the egg stage of the genetically engineered salmon. They plan to grow and sell the eggs to commercial fish farms who will then raise the fish for market. This is what they say. Fish grown from Aqua Advantage eggs are all female and sterile, making it impossible for them to breed amongst themselves. In addition, FDA approval requires them to be grown in physically contained systems, further reducing any potential impact on wild populations. This sounds good, but it hasn't been enough to satisfy opponents of the genetically engineered fish.
Aqua Bounty, the company behind this so-called Frankenfish, insists that what they've created poses no threat to wild salmon because they say that these fish will be kept in controlled pens and never get out. But they're wanting to market the eggs, not the fish. And once production of genetically engineered fish is commercialized, they can't control everywhere those eggs go. So some degree of release may be inevitable. And research published in the National Academy of Sciences found that a release of just 60 genetically engineered salmon into a wild population of 60,000 would lead to the extinction of the wild population in less than 40 fish generations. And this is because this Aqua Advantage fish grows many times faster and becomes mature much more quickly than wild salmon. So there is a concern that it could outcompete wild salmon for food and reproduce at a much faster rate. Now, Aqua Bounty is telling us that their fish are sterile, but there's actually no guaranteed method for producing 100% sterility. And the FDA's most recent study found that 5% of the fish were, in fact, fertile. And those fertile fish, should they reproduce, will reproduce with offspring that are 100% fertile. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to deduce that if a lot of these fish escape into the wild, some percentage of them are going to survive. And it doesn't take a radical activist to be concerned that some of them might not just survive, but thrive, and in time destroy the wild salmon population, which is why a lot of wild salmon fishermen are really scared of this product.
Denise Hawkins, Fish and Wildlife Service regional geneticist, wrote to a colleague concerning the salmon's inability to reproduce, maybe the FDA should watch Jurassic Park. So what about impacts on human health? Aqua Bounty claims that the fish will be no different than other farmed salmon in health and quality. That said, farmed salmon has been shown to contain certain toxins not found in wild salmon.
Farmed salmon in general is pretty toxic for human health. And genetically engineered salmon would be, best case, more of that. You know, we know that conventional farmed Atlantic salmon is not recommended to be eaten more than once a month because of high levels of contaminants like PCBs, dioxins, dieldrin, and toxaphene. It's a completely different product than the wild salmon that a lot of people think of as having such great health benefits.
We would hope that the FDA would work to protect consumers from these potential risks caused by this new food. But one red flag about genetically engineered salmon is how it is being regulated.
The approval for Aqua Bounty is being handled by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and they chose to review Aqua Advantage as an animal drug rather than a human food. So in the FDA's view, the refashioned DNA that's in every cell of this fish's body is considered a drug. That's what they're regulating. And if it's approved, Aqua Advantage salmon would not only be the first genetically engineered animal approved for human consumption, it would also be the first animal drug that's theoretically capable of swimming off into the ocean and reproducing.
A drug that could swim? Man, that'd be a great sci-fi novel. According to Aqua Bounty, the nutritional and biological composition of Aqua Advantage salmon is identical to Atlantic salmon. On this basis, current law and policy would not require additional labeling based upon method of production. The product should be labeled Atlantic salmon. Obviously, if this was really the case, that the modified salmon is the same as Atlantic salmon, then there wouldn't be a copyright symbol next to Aqua Advantage. It seems convenient for Aqua Bounty that the fish is a new and different species during the patenting process, but the same as Atlantic salmon when marketing it to consumers. Differences aside, would genetically engineered fish at the grocery store need to be labeled as such?
Rather alarmingly, at this point in time, there is no labeling requirement for any genetically engineered foods, which includes salmon. And so, as a result, no, you could have frankenfish on your dinner plate by the end of 2013 and have no idea what you're actually eating.
The FDA has approved genetically engineered salmon for human consumption based predominantly on research either by or paid for by Aqua Bounty. Winona Hodder, author of Foodopoly, executive director of Food and Water Watch, and recent guest on The Food Show, has this to say about the research that has brought about the approval of genetically engineered salmon.
The research that was done to promote the legalization was really terrible. And some of the tests, they used only six fish. They got rid of any fish that had any health problems or looked odd. I mean, when you read through the research, a high school student could figure out, you know, in a high school science class that this was bogus.
The next step following the FDA's approval is a public commenting period where people can either defend or oppose the salmon. This is where we are currently within the process.
Yeah, the FDA took a historic step. They opened up a comment period, which for all practical matters seemed like it was purely perfunctory. They were required to have a 60-day comment period before they could launch approval, and they already made it clear that they were planning to approve it, but they got so many comments during that comment period that they decided to extend it for another 60 days. So we now have until late April to continue keeping the comments flowing in.
If you go to the Food and Water Watch website, you can send a comment on genetically engineered salmon to the FDA via an online form. Go to their main page, click on Campaigns, and then click on Stop GE Salmon. One of the reasons why this issue is so heated is because it could dictate the future of bioengineering and production animals.
Well, Aqua Bounty had faced bankruptcy because it is a very sketchy kind of company. Mm-hmm. And it's now been bailed out by the biotech industry. It would have gone bankrupt. But the biotech industry sees this as a do-or-die mm-hmm. kind of legalization.
There are clearly high stakes concerning this issue, and we'll be keeping an eye out on the developments with genetically engineered salmon here on The Food Show. Thank you to Ocean Robbins and Winona Hodder for their input. Be sure to visit The Food Show at kboo.fm or on Facebook for links to information about genetically engineered salmon, and tune in to future food shows for updates.
Hello, boys and girls. My name is Fat Lip. And this is my friend, Sammy the Salmon.
What it do?
Today, we're going to teach you some fun facts about salmon and a brand new dance. Let me introduce to you a brand new dance. I know you're going to love it if you give it one chance. It's not complicated. It's not too hard. You don't even have to be a hip-hop star. See, anyone can do it. All you need is style. Listen up, peep gang, I'ma show you how. Put your hands to the side, as silly as it seems, and shake your body like a salmon floating upstream. You know how we do it,
again.
You are tuned in to the food show on KABU. I mentioned earlier that I went down to Salem this past Monday for the Oregon Small Farmers and Ranchers Day rally. And I want to talk to you. I'm going to actually play some clips from that rally, but I want to tell you a few of the issues that are kind of going on in the Oregon legislature that were talked about that day. So there's one that's a bill that would bring more funding for farm-to-school and school-garden programs. There's a bill that would change how aggregate mines operate in the Willamette Valley. Currently, they destroy a fair amount of farmland that once that farmland is used for mining, it's gone for good. There's also a really awesome bill that it's called the Aggie Bonds Bill that will make it easier for individuals who want to farm to receive loans for land and equipment. And then kind of the most important one in my perspective is the bill that would call for excluding canola from the Willamette Valley. Canola will have a devastating effect on the specialty seeds industry in the Willamette Valley, on vegetable growers. And once it's in the Willamette Valley, canola, it won't leave. So if you want more information on any of these issues, you can check it out on the Friends of Family Farmers website. They've got a lot of great resources there. So here's some voices from the Oregon Small Farmers and Ranchers Day rally.
I am just blown away at how many people would come and spend a beautiful sunny day with us here when this was a field day for a lot of people and travel from all across the world.
I think it's just important to participate in the democratic process. This is a total first for me, but I feel very inspired just being walking the halls and actually having a chance to talk with my representative who I voted for. And talk to him about issues that are important to me and to other small farmers and the small farm community in and around Portland.
No, we're bringing it up today. We've been over to the Oregon Department of Ag. We've talked with Katie Koba, who's been very gracious. And as always, the Oregon Department of Ag has been excellent to work with. But we're also bringing it up with our representative, Brad Witt, and our state senator, Senator Betsy Johnson.
A quick little bit about my background. I grew up on a farm. My dad farms in western Washington County, just outside of Cornelius. And so the work that you guys are doing to advocate for our agricultural economy at all different levels is really important to me. And I think it's really important to the state. So first of all, thank you so much for the work that you're doing. The issues that you're bringing to this legislature are really important. The work of Friends and Family Farmers has already started to transform the debate around what agriculture is and can be and should be for the state of Oregon.
Well, we need to support the rest of the vegetable seed growers on the canola issue. We've raised vegetable seeds before. We understand canola. It's a huge issue for us in our mint fields, and it's a very hard weed to get rid of. Our kids are trying to buy ground, and it's very hard to obtain financing for young farmers and ranchers.
But I don't know, you
I think personally. I think access to land for new farmers. There's a huge, there's a lot of energy, people wanting to farm, wanting to get into the small scale sustainable farm field and bring new energy to it. But it's hard for those folks to get funding and to get onto land. So it seems like that's maybe the one of the biggest issues facing agriculture in Oregon today.
So the big one that I want to talk about was aggregate mining. Particularly the folks from Grand Island will know all about this. We had the hearing in land use, but the industry is fighting back extremely hard. So I need help. If I'm going to be able to move that bill, I'm going to need help.
Is there an alternative to mining that is not on our best soils, our class one and class two soils, the best farmland? They're not making any more of it. Is mining really the best and highest use?
No.
we most of us would resoundingly say no, and there's other options.
Well, the issue that's most important to me is funding OSU Extension Services, because they are talking about keeping the budget the same, which would result in a lot of faculty cuts. And at Zenger Farm, we do farmer training, and a lot of our interns go through OSU workshops like Growing Farms, and we definitely use the advice from Extension agents, and we go to the Small Farms Conference and the Small Farm School that they put on. So all of that, all of those programs are at risk of at least diminishing, if not being cut.
There were many of them today, but the two that stood out for me were the canola bill. So we are pushing to protect the Willamette Valley from canola being grown for biofuels and other things. It wreaks havoc with a lot of the vegetable growers and the seed producers in the Willamette Valley. So that one was important to me, as well as just increased funding for farm-to-school initiatives throughout the state.
We need to preserve this valley, this Willamette Valley, for what it really is best used for, and that's to continue to be a world-class place to grow seeds.
That's the one message I want to leave you with. Seeing the growth of this organization in the last 6 years has been astonishing. When I started in 2007, there wasn't a voice for a lot of these issues.
Together, with all of your help, we can have healthier kids, healthier farmers, healthier rural economies. Thank you for being here.
That was Leah Rogers, Sarah Kogan, Brian Allen, Mike Seeley, State Representative Ben Unger, Laura Masterson, Frank Morton, and Cassandra Griffin. I want to thank them all for participating, and all the folks who attended the Oregon Small Farmers and Ranchers Day rally for their passion for a sustainable food future.
And thank you, Chris, for getting down there to attend that rally. A group of food scientists at Oregon State University are researching food barley with an emphasis on barley as a component of whole grains in diets. Beta-glucan is one focus. They also seek to stimulate local barley production and local barley products. Barley has been awarded a health statement by the FDA. It states that, and I quote, "The Food and Drug Administration confirms that including barley in a healthy diet may reduce the risk of heart disease by lowering total and LDL cholesterol," end of quote. Pat Hayes is a professor at Oregon State University working on the breeding and genetics of barley. Mary Klusky is a professor of nutrition, a registered dietitian nutritionist. She works to come up with recipes for consumers that are both healthy and enticing. Andrew Ross is a cereal chemist. His job is to measure quality traits of the barley as it comes out of the breeding program. He is a baker and does product development in his research bakery. Bridget Meintz is a master's student in plant breeding and genetics, working with food barley, breeding new varieties using Himalayan germplasm to bring in color and potentially novel flavors and aromas, and also to characterize some nutritional qualities in barley. I recorded my talk with them on the phone line in a KABU studio. The first voice you will hear will be Professor Pat Hayes.
We started in on the barley research project here about 7 years ago, and we've been working on a number of other traits in barley for the past 27 years. Particularly malting quality and disease resistance and resistance to various biotic stresses. And for a lot of reasons, we decided to start working on barley for human health and nutrition, and so that brings us to today's talk.
Barley's been around for, what, 10,000 years?
Yeah, barley has been around for at least 10,000 years in human diets. People probably started out in many areas of the world eating barley, and it remained an important part of their diet, but then it was replaced by wheat in the Western world largely and by rice in the Eastern world. And people just left barley behind, and as a consequence, then we have all the miseries of modern life.
Why did they leave it behind?
If you want a risen bread, then you're going to have trouble making that certainly out of all barley. And then if you're going to have barley as a component of that bread, that's going to be a bit more of a challenge to the baker. And if you're in Asia, then rice was convenient and productive and tasty. So as a consequence, you wound up with barley being an important food in kind of three areas of the world. One would be the what would be now Ethiopia. Second would be the Himalayan region of Asia. and then barley was introduced into the Andean region of South America by the Spanish and has persisted there.
And barley, I understand, grows readily in a lot of different climates and different soils.
Yeah, it's a fairly tolerant sort of a plant, and so it's grown everywhere from the Arctic Circle to the tropics, but in general would prefer drier climates than wetter ones. But that said, it does do very well in the Willamette Valley and in Western Oregon.
And today, most of the barley that we grow gets used as malted barley for beer and for animal feed. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. And so the barley for food is a something that we're really trying to promote in the U.S. You've had the FDA-approved health claim for barley since about 2006, and yet the barley foods just, despite a lot of effort and great research, have just really haven't quite gotten the traction that we'd like them to get. And so our approach here, in working with Andrew and Mary and then through Bridget's research, is to try to really capitalize on the fact that in Oregon we have an adventurous cuisine. We have people who are interested in health, and we have a tremendous interest in the local foods movement. So if we can put all those things together, then barley could stand a chance of success here, and then hopefully the good word would then move on through the rest of the country.
Mary Klusky is a nutritionist.
Barley in particular has a high concentration of beta-glucans. And beta-glucans is an insoluble fiber. The insoluble fibers is what people think of as roughage, the things that speed things through the GI tract. Soluble fibers are those that absorb sometimes fluid and toxins that are in the gut and facilitate removal of things that are sort of precursors to development of cholesterol, etc. So primarily it is that fiber content that's unique. There are some other grains that have it, but barley is particularly rich.
The scientific evidence does say that barley can lower your cholesterol and is good for your heart.
Correct. And getting FDA approval for a health claim is not a small deal. That means there's sufficient evidence. It's not evidence for which there's controversy or debate.
What else would you like to tell us about your work with barley?
I find that the public kind of divides themselves among two groups. One is there are people who are particularly motivated and healthy, willing to try things, and they are not probably as challenging for us to sort of persuade to try healthy foods or new foods. And a bigger percentage of the people are, yes, they know they need to eat healthy, but they're not familiar with some of these foods. They don't really know what to do with them. They're looking for easy solution. They'd be willing to eat healthy as long as they felt like it. They could do it in the amount of time and money that they were willing to invest. And that's sort of the audience that I'm pursuing. The bigger chore in my profession is try to work with people that are not so motivated in that regard and try to give them familiarity, give them things to make it easier for them to incorporate different and new foods into their diets that are healthy.
And do you know where we're at with getting it in the stores? I've noticed that, well, we can usually get pearl barley, which means it's been processed to some degree and the hull is taken off. But some of the nutrients go with that, just like processing wheat.
Bridget might want to be the one that talks to you about this a little bit as one of the challenges that we have with any kind of a new sort of ingredient that's not been typically used in American diet is we don't have great data on the nutrients, the micronutrients that are in there.
Let's hear from Bridget.
Hello.
How do we go about this?
We are in the process of releasing the first winter Hollis food barley. It's called Streaker because it's naked. Currently we have predicted about 600,000 pounds of Streaker that will be produced in the Willamette Valley and available in 2013. And Streaker is a six-row barley. I mentioned it's a winter type, so you plant it in the fall. And it's a blend of three sister lines, and it has the unique grain color. It's actually a mix of blue, brown, and white grain. So that is probably going to be the most readily available. One of the barleys that is being grown in the Willamette Valley right now that is purple is called Karma. It's a landrace that was collected in Tibet in the 1940s, and actually We've had a lot of interest from growers in the Willamette Valley and Camas Country Mill down in Junction City. They're growing Karma and Streaker, as I mentioned, and they have a mill, so they're producing flour, and they're also selling whole grain. And then they also sell grain to Hummingbird Wholesale in Eugene. They might be the ones who are actually getting that grain out to the co-ops. We're actually looking at antioxidant properties that might be related to the color in the grain. And so one of the things that I will be measuring for my research is antioxidant and phenolic and anthocyanin properties in the grain.
Where should we go from here?
Baking, perhaps?
Hello.
Hi, Andrew.
Barley actually has a fairly long history as the raw material for baked goods. So if you go back into Mesopotamia, you know, 10,000 years ago, or they were using barley, and it may at some point have got supplanted by emmer, which is one of the ancient wheats. And two areas that I'm kind of obsessed with, one of them is sourdough fermentations, and the other one is mixed flour types of bread, so composite flours.
Uh-huh.
And so there's a model for what we're doing with the barley, which is really rye. So rye doesn't have functional gluten like wheat does. And so if you add rye to a bread, it tends to be a bit denser and more chewy. And and so there's a really useful kind of template there and almost like pre-existing recipes for doing risen breads. And we've been doing those with some success and finding some little tricks, just for example, things like soaking the barley flour for, you know, a number of hours before you put it into the dough so that it just seems to operate better. It hydrates properly. We've had models like that and some success with risen bread. But the other things that we've been doing with it that are really kind of right up its alley are in flat types of breads. So we've been formulating barley into pita bread and into tortillas at up to 50% replacement of the wheat.
Mm.
And they're really, really good.
Can you give us a simple recipe that might encourage people to want to go out and try to use barley?
For folks at home, if they were to look up like a whole wheat tortilla recipe and just replace the whole wheat with barley.
With barley flour.
With barley flour, yeah. And they probably need to add a little bit more water. That would be the biggest issue, because the thing with barley is that because it's got all this wonderful fiber in it, it's very thirsty as a flour.
Mm-hmm.
So you know yourself from any baking experience that you have that whole wheat absorbs more water than white flour. Whole barley absorbs more water than whole wheat. So, you know, a tortilla recipe would be a great place to start. They're really simple, you know, few ingredients. If people have got any experience with making a pita bread, or they have a recipe for that, like for a 50% whole wheat pita, just simply replacing the whole wheat flour with barley flour would be a way to go.
The barley flour that you use, do you grind it yourself?
You know, I live in this little self-referential bubble. I have my own mills. I have my own bakery. I have my own source of barley. You can source barley flour from a number of mills on the West Coast. In general, my feeling about it is it's usually barley flour that's been ground up from pearl barley. So it's missing a little bit of the bran layer. But that's not completely a problem for barley, because this soluble fiber, which is really the golden component, is evenly distributed throughout the kernel. So you don't diminish that quality by that early processing. In supermarkets that I go to here, you can actually buy packaged barley flour. I can buy barley flakes, barley grits, and from bulk bins in some of my local supermarkets, and certainly co-ops. Most barley that people are used to comes with a husk, which has to be ground off, and which is the pearling process.
Mm-hmm.
But to try and, for a number of reasons, one of them being so that we can actually have truly the definition of whole grain barley, is that we've been focused for the food barleys on breeding hullless varieties. So these varieties thresh freely, just like wheat does. So the seed falls out of the husks. And at such point, that material doesn't have to be further processed before it gets milled. It can just go straight into the mill, and it comes out equivalent to whole wheat or whole rye. And so you have the benefits then of both the soluble fiber from the beta-glucan and, of course, the insoluble fiber from the bran.
Are there some other barley products that you're baking?
We've been making soft pretzels, which are about 40% barley, which are just great. Pretzels need to be, you know, a bit chewy. They're not really that well risen, and they've worked out really well. Some of my other colleagues here have been making quick breads with them, muffins and such like that have turned out well, cookies.
Do you use gold barley for cookies?
For example, if you were doing oatmeal anything, you could just replace the rolled oats with rolled barley. That's the really, really simple one. We've been looking at actually putting barley flour into some of these. So cookies, you could get a double whammy of some barley flour and some rolled barley. And I know I can buy rolled barley from my local supermarket's bulk bins. And it's really good. I mean, it makes a great breakfast cereal. Yeah, there are all sorts of imaginative ways.
Let's go back to Patrick.
Full circle.
One of the things that is coming to mind is that barley is another example of poor man's food that kind of got shoved aside. Do you think that barley might become so popular that poor people won't be able to afford it?
Yeah, so that would be like the quinoa example.
It would be something like that. Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think so. And it's, you know, like the quinoa situation may be ameliorated to some extent if plant breeders and agronomists can figure out how to grow it properly here in the U.S. so that there's plenty of it around. And then that would take the pressure off the Andean supply. And then the bad news, of course, for some farmers is that they wouldn't be getting the same price for the crop that they'll get when it's scarce. So barley is very productive. You can get about 6,000 pounds of it per acre. So you plant 100 pounds and you get 6, 7, 8,000 back. And so it's, you know, currently would be selling for maybe 15, 20 cents a pound wholesale. And so it's hard to imagine that you would really get into a scarcity situation.
It also grows in more places than things like quinoa.
Yeah, there are issues related to quinoa. There is, in fact, a large research project right now that is directed at testing quinoas on both the east and the west side of Oregon. And so we also have barley trials on the east and west side of Oregon. And, you know, the machinery that's required for planting and harvesting and storing and distributing and everything is all available because you use the same equipment for raising wheat and barley and other cereals. So,
when I first met you, it was at the Organicology Conference at lunch, and you immediately told me about how you eat barley every morning for breakfast.
I have a programmable rice cooker, and I put my barley in there at night. And when I get down into the kitchen at 5:30, it's piping hot and ready to go. And so I have my bowl of Streaker or Willamette Pearl and just a bit of milk and fresh fruit.
Do you use 1 cup of barley for 3 cups of water?
If I were cooking on the stove, which is what I did for years before the rice cooker, I use a 3-to-1 ratio of water to barley. I prepare the barley like I would brown rice.
Mm-hmm.
And you can accelerate cooking time by cracking the barley. And that can be accomplished by putting the barley into a blender and running it for about a minute. And that'll kind of scrape it up a little bit. And Bridget is shaking her head, not a minute, 30 seconds. But the idea would be that the whole, particularly the whole grain hullus barley, has a rather kind of an impermeable husk on it. And
right.
So if you put that directly to boil, it's going to take a while. And so you're going to have a very crunchy product. One of the things we'll be working on with Mary's class next quarter, and then I'll put her on to talk about that, is going to be barley pilaf sorts of things.
Uh-huh.
And so I eat the barley for breakfast in the rice cooker set on a brown rice setting, but that same cooked material is really suitable for then a number of other purposes. So you can season that, you know, from Mediterranean to Asian to whatever sort of route you want to go, add vegetables and other things, sauces, and use it in wraps, for example. So there's a whole host of stuff you can do once you have that kind of base steamed barley.
You know, each year I have a group of students, it's about 40, and they're a mixture of culinary as well as nutrition students. And so, you know, it's a good combination. In their young adults, they sort of are pretty open-minded about experimenting with things. And so we're going to be looking at things that are non-baking, because Andrew has done a lot of work on baked products. And so pilafs, we're going to look at perhaps some sort of a garden burger, if you will, maybe some energy bars, salads, interesting salads and combinations. And what we're going to get into with barley is there's some texture issues, and I heard Pat talking to you about the cooking time. So those are the things that, you know, if you really want people to do it, it has to be something that they're familiar with, it's going to have to taste good, and it's going to have to be something that works in their life.
Before we hang up, I would like to thank everyone for participating, but I also want to give you the opportunity if there's something that we need to say that we haven't said.
Okay, well, my concluding statement is that I think barley is one of those things that's just lacking in familiarity, and one of the things that my interest in with this group is to help them develop a variety of ways that people can use barley and build its familiarity and use in American culture.
Hi, it's Bridget. We actually have a website, barleyworld.org/food. Where we are posting recipes, information, data from our food trials. And so we'd welcome anyone to go visit that. We also have a Facebook page just called Barley World, and just trying to get the word out on how tasty barley is and how healthy it is.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, we really appreciate you having us on the show, and, you know, we'd like to get the barley into sort of the people's consciousness so that they would be asking for barley and really want it because of its culinary properties of flavor and aroma and texture, rather than saying, well, gee, you got to take my barley today. And there really are huge differences even in the different sorts of barley that we work with. There really are differences in aroma. There's differences in texture, flavors, and so forth. And so that's where we'd like to push this and just give people a whole lot of more really exciting and cost-effective culinary alternatives.
I'm very happy I got to talk to each of you.
Well, thanks so much. And if you're ever down in Corvallis, come by, and I'd be glad to show you our research.
So I'm one of the motivated eaters that Mary was talking about, who's willing to try different things. So I have tried cooking and eating barley and have gone back to my co-op and bought more of that beautiful purple karma that's grown in the Willamette Valley. I haven't found the gold barley yet, and I haven't found any barley flour already ground, but I'm going to keep looking. I think that there's a few more places I can try. But I also wanted to tell you that there, when you go to barleyworld.org, there's many other links to information and photographs, et cetera, et cetera. One of the ones I found that is helpful was barleyfoods.org.
And I just want to add, we grew barley this last year at Wealth Underground Farm, and hearing that, it made me really excited to grow the Streaker barley. So I'm hoping I can get access to some of that from them at some point. That'd be really cool.
600,000 pounds of it.
Yeah.
That's a lot of barley, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Great. Well, we're coming to the end of the program, but I have an announcement from a previous guest to the food show. The Urban Farm Collective, which is a group that is actively working to expand people's access to fresh vegetables across Portland, is having a tool drive this Saturday between 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. If you have garden tools to donate, you can find Urban Farm Collective Garden in your neighborhood by visiting the website urbanfarmcollective.com. There's a map page on their site where you can identify a garden near you.
And that concludes the March edition of the Food Show. Tune in on the third Wednesday of every month in this time slot. Thanks to our guests and the many voices that made today's show happen, and to Kurt, the master of control in the KABU Air Room. KABU is community radio, member-owned and volunteer-driven. You won't hear the Food Show during our spring membership drive that begins tomorrow, but you can still support us. When the phone answerer asks you what you like about KABU, tell them you like the Food Show. Thanks for listening, and remember to be a voting member of KABU. Have a great day. Bye, Chris.
Bye, Kate.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd Avenue, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. This program was also brought to you in part by Artemis Foods, Portland's local organic and sustainable catering company since 2001. Special events, corporate and wedding catering with seasonal menus and service supported by sustainable business operations. They offer full service and drop-off catering. Information by phone or through their website, www.artemisfoods.com. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 100.7 FM Corvallis in Albany. The time is 11:56. Coming up next is the headline news.
This is KBOO Noon News. Because of increasing nuclear threats from North Korea and Iran, the United States plans on expanding its West Coast nuclear defenses. The Defense Department will add 14 missile defense interceptors at a site in Alaska and build a radar tracking station in Japan. While the missiles are designed to shoot down enemy airborne attacks, limited testing has been done to validate their capability. It is doubtful that North Korea is now capable of launching missiles that will reach the United States, and Iran could have a functioning nuclear weapon developed in a year or so.
United States drone strikes in Pakistan are completely unwanted and illegal, according to a United Nations statement made today. Pakistan claims the strikes have killed hundreds of their civilians and are in violation of their airspace. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism estimates nearly 900 civilians have died from these strikes during the Obama presidency. The government of Pakistan says it is willing to combat terrorists and its root causes. The UN feels that the international community needs to give Pakistan the space and assistance to combat terrorism without military interference.
The strictest abortion legislation in the country is expected to be voted on in North Dakota this Friday. One bill would ban most abortions if a heartbeat can be detected, which can occur as early as the first 6 weeks. The second bill would ban abortions based on gender selection or gender defect, such as Down syndrome. Both measures have already passed the North Dakota House.
Last week, a number of Portland high school students walked off their campuses in protest against standardized testing. The students who want the testing to have an opt-out clause traveled to Salem to take their message to state lawmakers. They claim that the tests discriminate against students by race and class, as well as providing an inaccurate representation of actual knowledge gained.
The Cleveland police are being investigated by the Justice Department for their use of excessive and unreasonable deadly force. Local city officials requested an investigation after a car chase resulted in two dead, 130 shots fired by police, and the two suspects being shot 47 times. 13 officers are on administrative leave pending the outcome. The investigation will consider broad allegations, not just this one incident.
A ban that would outlaw 157 military-style assault weapons was debated last Thursday by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Opponents claim criminals will have the banned weapons while citizens will have pea shooters. Senator Dianne Feinstein said that the 2,271 exempt weapons were good enough for self-defense. On Wednesday, the bill failed to get the approval to be put before the full Senate.
This is Diane Erickson and Patrick Wilson with the KBOO Noon News, Portland, Oregon. Listen every night at 5 o'clock for more local, national, and international news. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. It's 12 o'clock here at KBOO Portland. This is Rita Rega. I'm sitting in for Nick this afternoon on Jazz Lives. I want to start off with a new one from drummer Terry Lynn Carrington. It's called Money Jungle here at KBOO.
Pew
people are basically vehicles to just create money, which must create more money to keep the whole thing from falling apart, which is what's happening. There is no profit under the current paradigm. In saving lives, putting balance on this planet, having justice and peace or anything else. You have to create problems to create profit.